Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, and welcome to the Songs of Note podcast. I am your host, Ryan Gregg. I'm so glad you're here to talk about some music today. Okay, so today we're talking about Guns N' Roses. All right, now some of you are like, yes, and some of you are like, ooh, that's my guess at least. So here's what I think. There are some bands that are a little bit of an enigma when you look back at them historically, I guess. And in some ways, there's no doubt that Guns N' Roses is freaking awesome. They have some amazing songs. They have some songs that are like so fun to crank. And I say fun. There is a flip side to that, where when you look at some of their work, some of it can be seen in the context of the times, and it's cringeworthy, might be the word that the kids are saying today, lyric-wise on some of the things. And so, overall, I like some Guns N' Roses. I put it on in a different way than I listen to the Beatles or than I listen to some different bands, but I put it on, like, in the same, for me, in the same way I would put on Back in Black or like, just a good rock, upbeat, stadium rock might be the way to that you could phrase that. And so in today's episode, I'm talking with Eric Weisbard, and he wrote a 33 and a third book on Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. And it was a really interesting read, actually, and we talk about it here in the interview. There's some good personality in it, and it can be easy for those books to just be historical and not have personality, but I thought this one was great. So that's it. If you're here for the first time, be sure and subscribe. If you're here for the whatever 100th, well, there's only been in the 80s of episodes, but if you've been here for a bunch of episodes, man, I'm glad you're here. I appreciate it. Thank you for listening. And I hope you enjoy the episode. This is Eric Weisbard. Well, hey, Eric, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show and talk about Guns N' Roses. Glad to have you here today.
Thanks for inviting me. It's always an interesting experiment when one is asked to revisit a book one wrote about 15 years ago about an album from more than 30 years ago. I feel really old.
Oh, well, I understand that sentiment myself. Somebody sent me a message, a friend sent me a message today saying Abbey Road came out closer to the release of Nirvana's Nevermind than we are to Nirvana's Nevermind. Those differences were closer, and that made me feel very old as well. So Guns N' Roses, let's talk about this band, because I read your 33 and a third book. And I loved hearing kind of the background on some of these songs and the what the band was going through, which is what what my podcast is about. But Guns N' Roses is a funny band, and what I liked about your book is you were kind of willing to rip on them a little bit, and then also say when what they did was good. How did you approach this book, like deciding to write it, and how did you take that angle?
The two things that I would sort of say drove the book were a goofy idea and then a really dismal reality. So the goofy idea was Use Your Illusion, which was put out as two separate compact discs, Use Your Illusion 1 and Use Your Illusion 2, has the acronym UYI. And I was enormously fond of a book called You and I, not in any way related to the subsequent Lady Gaga song, but the letter U, ampersand I. It's a book by Nicholson Baker about his relationship to John Updike, who he barely knew at all, in which Baker wrote about Updike's work without ever revisiting it. And just let the way that Updike's work had permeated his consciousness become the focus of the book. And so my very goofy, silly idea was, well, if there's a you and I, why can't there be a UYI and I, where I write about Use Your Illusion without ever listening to it? So that was the goofy idea. The dismal reality was I was writing it at a moment when I wasn't sure I had any future writing about music at all. And many people who I'd come up with, who I saw as friends and colleagues, were in the same boat, because the world of alternative rock that had fostered us into writing for money was dead. And really the music business was dying and journalism was ailing. And, you know, so basically this book is the only book I'll ever write that has no acknowledgments, because I felt like I had nothing to say to anybody.
Well, I loved it because you even talk about that in the book. You're like, I'm not going to listen. I'm not going to listen back. I'm going to write about it, and I'm going to try to write about it objectively without being thrown back into listening to it with new ears, right? And I thought that was a really interesting way to take it on. Let's start right before you use your illusion. Appetite for Destruction was the album that came out before either of these records and blew up. I mean, they were huge. They sold 8 million copies of it. And you made the point, like you just said, that they made the incredibly arrogant move of releasing two single discs instead of a double disc, which was funny. But just how big was Guns N' Roses coming into the Use Your Illusion records?
Guns N' Roses had managed to do two or three different things simultaneously. And for a while, that really made them seem like the world's biggest rock band. They were part of the world of Sunset Strip, Los Angeles heavy metal, which throughout the 1980s was a big commercial force, from Van Halen to Motley Crue and a lot of other hair metal bands. But they were also, this is maybe their second claim to credibility, more so than most of those bands, really rivaled only by their Northern California peers, Metallica. They had a connection to punk rock and to the sort of world of music that much Los Angeles heavy metal seemed to pretend didn't exist. So they seemed cooler and more informed than a lot of the LA Sunset Strip bands. And then the third piece that really only started to become apparent with Use Your Illusion was they were trying in their own way to do something similar to what, say, Perry Farrell was doing with Lollapalooza, which debuted the same summer that Use Your Illusion was released, which is to say, create a kind of alternative rock, create something that pushed against rock norms. It just turned out that where that third part was concerned, that they weren't nearly as good at it as Nirvana, who put out a record more or less at the same moment and made Use Your Illusion Forevermore seem like the last vestige of a washed up group of rejects from a scene that was never as good as it should have been. Oh, well, that's rock and roll for you.
There you go. Well, so like, okay, so I'm a huge Nirvana fan, and I always thought it was funny seeing Axl Rose wearing a Nirvana hat, like even in one of their music videos. It felt less like, hey, here's a band that's on the same level as us, and I'm a fan of, because like Soundgarden, like Chris Cornell would wear like a Nirvana shirt. When Axl did it, I felt like he was, and I could just be reading into this, but I felt like he was saying, look at us in the same way you look at Nirvana. We're serious artists too. And the whole time I was like, nah, I don't know. Y'all aren't doing the same thing. Did you think that at all?
I mean, it's really complicated. One of the arguments that Chuck Klosterman makes in Fargo Rock City, his book about sort of growing up through all this stuff, is that in a lot of ways, both Axl Rose and Kurt Cobain were what Klosterman calls redneck intellectuals. They both came from sort of white working class backgrounds, grew up in obscure places, didn't have the kind of access to underground hipster culture that people with college parents living in bigger cities might have had. Even at the level of reference points, there's no question that where Kurt Cobain had 1,000 underground music reference points by the time he came to visibility and could tell you about the Vaselines or the Raincoats, Axl Rose was still the guy who, you know, put songs like Ain't It Fun into the Spaghetti Incident album of cover versions, who could totally and credibly say, punk rock changed my life. His was a narrower version of Kurt Cobain's cultural realm, for sure. One of the unresolved question since, among other things, over the years, we've seen Axl become a more or less outspoken liberal kind of commentator on the world, where someone like a Kid Rock, for example, is an outspoken right-wing commentator on the world. So one of the questions that's left for us to think about 30 years after the so-called feud between Nirvana and Guns N' Roses is just, why did we judge things a certain way back then? When I wrote this book, which was about 15 years later, I was already starting to revise my judgments. And now, 30 years later, I would say I see far more similarities than I do differences, including the fact that both of them were ultimately unable to overcome the sort of competing forces in their heads.
Now, that is not something that I would expect to land on today, but that's really fascinating. I mean, that is an interesting take on it. And I think when I think back to when this album came out, I forget about all the other great music that was coming out at the same time. When we look at the fall of 1991, I mean, huge classic albums, Pearl Jam's 10, Nirvana's Nevermind, Metallica's Black Album, U2's Acting Baby, and now Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. Does Guns N' Roses belong in that list of greats right there with these albums or not?
I think that for most human beings, what has become the preserved remnant of that moment where Guns N' Roses are concerned is the November Rain video on MTV and now on YouTube. And I think to this day, if you look on Spotify and see how many plays November Rain has gotten, or look on YouTube and see how many viewings the video has gotten, that one moment has lingered on.
I think it's
a kind of amazing sequence that this 150 minute long double disc sold separately piece of compact disc merchandising ultimately gets winnowed down to one enormously elongated shot of Slash playing guitar captured from a helicopter. So, you know, time really plays its tricks on people. But that does mean that in some fundamental way, there's a sense that what Guns N' Roses were doing in that moment is part of that fall of 1991 conversation. That if we want to think about music 30 years ago, we're thinking about a moment where all the great 90s trends haven't fully happened yet.
Yeah.
Garth Brooks isn't fully Garth Brooks. Nirvana isn't fully Nirvana. Mm-hmm. Dr. Dre hasn't really introduced the world to Snoop Dogg. You know, all these things are still to come. But what there already is a sense that people want this new decade to break in different ways than in the past. And in that moment, in the fall of 1991, when so many of these albums are coming out, MTV was the crucial partner. It was always about, yes, I want to be played on radio, but maybe I'm not going to be played on radio. And so if I'm not going to get necessarily played on radio because radio is much more conservative, can I have the kind of exposure on MTV that will make not just my music, but my place in the culture burst out. And that was what MTV was doing that summer. You know, long before November Rain proved to be the enduring version of this, the example that stood in for what Axl Rose thought he was doing was the You Should Be Mine video, which featured Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator mode. And so this notion that, like, you know, Guns N' Roses would use the full force of MTV and the music industry and the promotional money at their disposal to kind of put forth a product that could not be resisted, that was going to kill you one way or another. that, you know, they never pretended at that moment to be David. They were completely Goliath. And right. So, you know, and so as a result, that helped in a weird way position Nirvana as David with the slingshot, you know, taking down the giant.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, that's a really good comparison. This is self-confession. It can be easy for me to slip into the mode of things that are wrong with a band or bad about a band. But there's some things about Guns N' Roses that is still like awesome. There are some awesome tracks on these two records. Like, what are the things for you looking back that you can go, okay, this song was good, or I really think that this is worthwhile about this band? Are there things that stick out to you?
I think for me, when I made ultimately my sort of one disc version of Use Your Illusion for the sheer sake of being able to listen to it without flinching a lot, including at all the Izzy tracks. What I was left with was a kind of perverse appreciation for the bigness of the project. There were a small song or two. I mean, I will always love the song Yesterdays. Because it's got a craggy little melody and it feels like just one of those songs that lots of artists who focus on other things might come up with at some point in their career, a kind of like, I got to walk before they make me run in Rolling Stones terms, or the kind of thing you could imagine Johnny Thunders with the Heartbreakers setting down with an acoustic guitar. Just one of those little things that lingers. But mostly what it's about is this bigness, this kind of gothic architecture, the sense that if you're going to be Guns N' Roses at this moment, you say, being the biggest band in the world is a responsibility, and we want to actually try sitting on the throne. And so what music are we going to make that feels like sitting on the throne? You can completely make fun of that. I mean, at that very moment, what U2 were doing with Achtung Baby was making fun of that. They had made the same decision just at that point of 3 or 4 years previously with Joshua Tree to make the biggest album they were capable of. With Achtung Baby, they, in a lot of ways, made fun of that impulse. Metallica, at that moment, were making a work that has the paradox of it being probably, Shania Twain is its rival, the biggest selling album of the whole SoundScan era, the album that sold more copies back in that, you know, period of barcode scans being the way we figured out what sold the most. And they did it with an album that a lot of their hardcore fans resented forever, thought was a sellout, a straightforward sort of commercializing. I don't hear it that way. What I hear is sort of similar to what I hear with Guns N' Roses, which is these were bands that made the decision in 1991 to try to be the kings of rock, to sit on the throne. And they did it in slightly different ways. It warped who they were and the music they made in some powerfully upsetting fashion. I don't think there's any human on the planet who thinks that the Use Your Illusion albums are better song for song than Appetite for Destruction. But what you're left with is this interestingly weird product. And interestingly weird can be a category that works at the underground level. That might mean someone listening to a Daniel Johnston record or listening to Sid Barrett after he'd halfway lost his mind. Mm-hmm. But interestingly weird can also be at the multi-million dollar mainstream level. It's Michael Jackson, you know, demanding pain medication on the song in Dangerous. You know, things like that. It's the rock version of what Kenneth Anger all those years back called Hollywood Babylon, you know, where we are fascinated by the tawdry qualities And then the final piece that sort of seems to be lingering in Use Your Illusion is it's an unfulfilled work. It's this thing where Axel tried to make this great piece of art and it didn't come off. And then he tried to turn it into at least a chronicle of his obsessions. And for November Rain, especially on the video, he got that across, but he wanted at least a trilogy of videos that did that. Didn't quite get there. And never could pick up the story again.
Isn't it interesting, like, when I look at November Rain, I think it's still a great song. I mean, I remember it, like, when it came out, and it was like, oh, this is really good. And I think it's certainly the peak for me of any Guns N' Roses song, or at least in the top three. But like when I listen to it, I can't help but think of Stairway to Heaven. Is this Guns N' Roses like version of Stairway to Heaven? Is this their scene that this is their rock moment, their ballad? This is the thing they're going to take their swing. And kind of to your point, like, I just wonder, so many bands like can nail this, and so many bands can hit this just left to center that it loses all of the intention behind it. Do you think that, I guess the question is, do you think that they executed November Rain in a way that it's still considered, is it still a really good song, or was it a novelty moment that we still look back on with nostalgia?
I think what's a little bit different is Guns N' Roses had already done the trick of a hard song and a soft song. With Appetite for Destruction, they had Welcome to the Jungle, and then they had Sweet Child of Mine. So they already did the thing of having a ballad and a rocker. They'd essentially covered those bases, where Led Zeppelin with Stairway to Heaven were thinking about balance. If you think about that fourth Led Zeppelin album, it has a mix of acoustic and electric. Even on the cover, it shows like an old peasant on one side and industrial buildings on the other side. It was about the kind of ability to have these different modes and show the world that Led Zeppelin couldn't be categorized as just a hard rock band, they were lots of things. I don't think that Guns N' Roses were doing that, in part because Axl was too maniacal and psychotic a figure. I think that what Axl was doing was more akin to a mad king trying to build a castle and never being happy with the construction. It was never magnificent enough. And then on a different level, I also think a difference between November Rain and Stairway to Heaven is that Stairway to Heaven has this architecture to it. It's getting louder and faster as it goes. It goes in a sequence of steps. November Rain, like a lot of Guns N' Roses songs, is one song, and then about two-thirds of the way through, it becomes a different song.
Yeah, that's true.
They're all together. It's one of their things. If you wanted to make comparisons, two other artists who love to do that 100 years ago was the Velvet Underground. And more recently, I swear to God, the singer Lucy Dacus loves to do that too. But what that means is that where the Led Zeppelin album and that Stairway to Heaven song feel very balanced and stable and enduring, November Rain and a lot of Guns N' Roses songs seem like they tried to keep it together and then everything fell apart.
I think that's true. Well, I was listening to your book as an audio book, and I was actually at the grocery store when this part came on, and you started talking about the lyrics to Sweet Child of Mine, which is not on this album, but I had to bring it up because I actually started laughing out loud. You ripped the lyrics of this song. Do you remember this?
No, not at all. Also, I have to say, I've never heard the audio version of my book, and I wasn't even positive there was an audio version of the book. So I hope whoever reads it sounds vaguely like in sympathy with my the way I bought.
Yeah, you know, I do it through, I think I bought it through like the Kindle version and I played it through the Alexa app. So I'm listening to it.
Okay.
And yeah, it was just talking about, you know, she's got, what's the line? She's got a smile. Seems to me reminded of childhood memories. And you were just ripping on her hair and the line and like, oh man, it really made me laugh. So I appreciate, I guess the takeaway, I appreciate the humor that you're able to approach a rock band and a serious album, or a serious attempt at an album, whatever you want to call it. This is still a cultural event. It's still something we're talking about all these years later. So like, it certainly made a mark.
Not unlike Axl Rose, because he's not that much different in age than me. When you grow up with 70s AM radio and top 40 songs like The Night Chicago Died or Indiana Wants Me or you know, That's the Way, I Like It, you're always going to have a twisted relationship to the notion of lyrics and music as some kind of art form, because you know in your gut that what moved you as a child, sweet or not, was something that was less than fully formed, that was a little bit ersatz, that was a construction of the moment that then lingered for decades to follow. And so you can try to turn rock into this estimable art form, and there are certainly albums that are more plausible when you want to put them up for that category. I've always been drawn to the kind of music that seems to have some kind of internal contradiction that lets you be a cultural critic even as you're listening, that lets you have mixed feelings. And there's a kind of complicated relationship to a flawed work that's much less easy to attain if you're dealing with a great perfect work. So I would never make the case that the flawed work is better, but I could make the case that for certain ways of thinking your way through life, it's better to have something that encourages you to disagree with it.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it interesting, right? I mean, it makes it interesting to talk about. So I'm going to loosely quote you, and I know you wrote this a while back, so if you don't remember, then we can move on. But you said somewhere in the book, something along the lines of, to quote, "The periods of my life when I felt the most at loose ends about who I am and where I am going and are when I relate most to these two albums, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. Do you remember at all what you're meaning there, what you were saying?
Yeah, I think so. And that's interesting that those lines stood out. They were a place in the book where I think some of the sense of this book as being written in a hard time for music writing was manifesting. So when I first was listening to the Guns N' Roses albums, I was starting two parallel careers with no sense that one or the other, or frankly either, was going to work out. I was writing for alternative weeklies back when those were basically where almost every music writer got their start. And I was also a graduate student in a history department at UC Berkeley. The sense in that Guns N' Roses experience that there was something to question about my previous life as a college radio DJ, calmly and knowingly loving Husker Du and the Mekons and Sonic Youth and all these other completely irreproachable indie bands. Guns N' Roses tested that at a time when I was feeling tested in a lot of different ways. And so I do think that it wasn't just that the Guns N' Roses albums were open to that kind of questioning. They appealed to me because I was trying to kind of break apart some of my own sensibilities. Fast forward to when I wrote that book, having then spent years as a music editor at the Village Voice and a writer for Spin Magazine through the 90s alternative rock years, and then having been a curator at a museum, so thinking about putting music in the past, all that was done when I wrote the Guns N' Roses book, and I was trying finally, after more than a decade away, to write my dissertation. And I wrote this book in between chapters of that dissertation, with the first chapter having received a harsh response from my committee at Berkeley and no sense that the next chapter was going to be well received. I wanted to write a book that would let me write in my own voice and wouldn't be criticized for it. And so at that moment, when the Village Voice had really faded as a place to write in that voice, and when many other things in my personal life, but also the music industry, the journalism industry, were in crisis, that sense of Axl Rose flailing, trying for things, not always getting there, and ending up stuck and stoic and lost appealed to me for sure. You know, now another 15 years later, I've got a tenured, I'm a full professor at a university. Life doesn't seem so harried personally. And I can sort of, you know, Axl Rose maybe can't write any good new songs, but he can tour the old ones for as long as he damn well pleases. You know, my sense of crisis around all this seems a little bit melodramatic in retrospect, but that certainly was informing some of the book. And maybe the last point I'd make is that there was a two-part sequence here. Axl Rose gets kicked out of rock by Kurt Cobain. Not entirely. He's back. It's fine. But let's just go with that metaphor. By the mid-2000s, there was a sense that rock had been kicked out of pop culture, that that certain rock notion of a certain kind of alienated white male performer who could nonetheless be paid by the multi-millions of dollars to express that alienation wasn't really a viable option either. So, you know, so the question became, as I was writing that book, basically, how much is about to depart the world altogether? Where it seemed in the 90s like we were having these big, interesting genre fights between alternative rock and gangster rap and new country, and then within each of these categories between different things. By the mid-2000s, it was no longer a question of like commodify your deviance. Anything, no matter how artistically edgy, can be sold. By the mid-2000s, the question was, can anyone make a living doing this at all? Can you make a living thinking about music? Can you make a living playing music? Can you have a life built around being obsessed with it? And so, you know, that was the sort of dread, I think, that was at the dismal reality part that was underlying that book.
Yeah, no, that I appreciate you sharing. I mean, I know I'm asking you a specific question about how you felt 15 years ago when you wrote this thing. And I think this stuff's interesting and it's tied into like what we're talking about a little bit. And I appreciate you being able to share that. When you look at now in retrospect, not only Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, but then like what went on to happen with Chinese Democracy. Like, can you talk about that story a little bit, just along like these albums come out, they're huge. Then what happens for Axl and for the band? What happened over those years generally leading up to finally the release of Chinese Democracy?
Yeah, I never felt it was my job to listen to Chinese Democracy, so I don't think I've ever listened to it in full, and I've definitely never held a copy of it, because by the time it came out, one didn't have to hold a copy to listen at least somewhat.
Right.
If there are videos attached to it, I haven't watched them. There was one moment where Blender magazine sent me to cover a Guns N' Roses concert in Southern California, probably right around the time Chinese Democracy came out. But I have honestly no memory of it, whereas I have a stronger memory of seeing Guns N' Roses headline over Metallica in the Bay Area on one of these ridiculous tours of the mega bands.
Wow.
You almost have to squint to see Axl now. Mm-hmm. You look at him and you're like, wait, where's the... Oh, yeah, I kind of see the guy that I whose face I know. And you kind of have to, whatever one does with one ears, that's the equivalent of squinting, to hear them in the world. I do think that in the same way that we were all recently informed that as far as young people are concerned, the most interesting older band of the 20th century is Queen, and these younger fans just want to stream Bohemian Rhapsody and songs like that. I do think that whether it's Welcome to the Jungle, November Rain, a couple of other songs, Guns N' Roses will retain a place in the repertoire and will be understood to be part of the story, especially of arena rock, which is only gradually being understood to have been a category, even as it's been one for now 50 years. Not quite the same as rock and roll, not quite the same as rock, certainly not the same as alternative rock, but connected to all those things, involving songs that for some reason audiences will assemble by the tens of thousands for the rest of their lives to be in the presence of the person who first recorded them into a microphone. That one thing, which is, I think, at the core of what rock, now that it's not at the center of pop culture, still offers more than any of its competitors. That's a category that Guns N' Roses are competitive in. And so on that level, I think they continue to be out there. I would love at some point to read writing from someone whose relationship to Guns N' Roses was completely formed after the fact, who has a 21st century relationship with Guns N' Roses. I would love to know what they mean for someone like that, because that's not something I'm capable of generating.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I appreciate you being willing to chat about it and to chat about the book and your experience with it. Like for me, when I am able to talk about an album or songs like this, like it's I'm able to separate a little bit and say, here's the things that were good about it. Here's the things that were really not good about it. But like, I still think that I still like putting Guns N' Roses on a couple songs, like Don't Cry, Live and Let Die, Civil War. There's some like really great songs for me that land in the like AC/DC category of like, I'm not going to go put this on with headphones and listen to it for hours, but like to put on a fun song or to put on a rock song that isn't cheese ball, I still think it lands in that category for me. Whereas like other 80s bands, I can't put on without feeling kind of like, oh, this is embarrassing. So it doesn't land in that category for me, but it does land in an interesting space in the release time, bumping up to grunge and all the things that came after it. So, man, Eric, I enjoyed your book. I appreciate you being willing to come on the show and kind of talk about it, about your experience and your thoughts on the band and the albums. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.